In the mid-1960s, there were four teenage women, high school students, who lived in Palo Alto. And it was during the time of getting high. And they heard about a Zen priest in San Francisco who could teach you how to get high naturally. So they trekked all the way up to San Francisco and searched out Suzuki Roshi at the little Japanese Zen temple in Japantown. And they showed up and they said, hey, you know, we'd like to learn how to get high naturally. And Suzuki Roshi invited them in, sat them down, and then he proceeded to give a talk to them on the Four Noble Truths, which maybe isn't automatically, obviously connected to getting high. But one of those young women was so amazed by how happy this man was talking about suffering. He was just, you know, and so that said, what is it this person has? What is it going on here? And so she then became a Zen student and to this day is a Zen practitioner, you know, 50 years later. So to be happy about suffering means to understand the opportunities of practice and freedom in addressing suffering, of meeting suffering. The Buddha once said that, in some ways, maybe summarizing his teachings, he said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And it's really the good news in Buddhism, the end of suffering. And to find a path that takes us there, to know the possibility of it, and to do something very profound, which the Buddha talked about. And that is, on the way there, to become disenchanted with suffering. Isn't that pretty far out? Are you still enchanted with your suffering? What does being enchanted look like? What does disenchanted mean? Why would that be an important teaching, the idea of becoming disenchanted with your suffering? I like the word enchantment in the sense that it means a spell. So are you under the spell of suffering? And can you learn to break that spell? So the suffering and the end of suffering, and the end of suffering is kind of like, you know, kind of a big deal. Ending it in small ways is a big deal, wonderful deal. Ending it in big ways is a big deal. But many times our suffering is big, complicated, difficult. It's not so easy to come to the end of it. And then there's an intermediate. There's a step along the way that supports our path, that fuels it, that inspires it. Something that belongs to, I would say, to the heart, body, and mind. And that is the refuges, going for refuge. In a sense, if you want, you could say the Buddha is about the mind, the Dharma is about the body, in a sense, and the Sangha is about the heart. But to have this inspiration, to have a knowing, to have an orientation, to have a course of action, and to have a kind of a wholehearted, perhaps love, as part of the path of practice and the kind of orientation, kind of the context and the holding of this amazingly wonderful thing to come to terms with suffering, with dukkha, to find a way out of it, to find the freedom from it. It's not meant to be a dry path that's just kind of, you know, dry and dull and kind of like mostly about renunciation and, you know, staying in your room and reading books and I don't know what, you know, just kind of being miserable as you look at suffering. There are some Buddhists who believe that the path to freedom of suffering lies through being miserable, and they're really good at it. But the path to freedom from suffering is not adding misery on top of our suffering, but to add the heart, to add inspiration, to add sense of purpose in a very beautiful way. And so the refuges kind of represent that, the three refuges. And just like each refuge represents, in a sense, body, mind, and heart, the Theravada tradition sees that one way of understanding all three refuges, what it means to go for refuge, is in fact to understand them from these three perspectives, to understand it as something that we know. There's a knowing. So it's not just something you take on faith. It isn't like someone says, you should take refuge, and then you say, oh yeah, and I'll take it on faith and go along. But refuge represents a knowing that comes from something that you know, you've come to know. And you've come to know it so well that it reorients you. You see, this is a new way of living, a new way of being. And that leads to the second aspect of refuge, which is having an orientation for action. Bodily action, verbal action, and mental action. An orientation for how we live our life, a sense of purpose, a direction to go. And the direction to go comes from this knowing that we have. We know something we didn't know before. And then the third aspect of refuge has to do with the heart, how we bring our heart into play. That it's, I like the word love. We bring our love to it. Our devotion, some people like that word, some people don't. Our wholeheartedness. It's something that we bring our heart into. It's not just a dry intellectual exercise. And so the refuges have these three aspects. And the knowing part ideally comes first. It doesn't always. Maybe I shouldn't say ideally. But the knowing part, we really understand what it means to go for refuge when you have had some experience of your own where you realize that some way you've been thinking, behaving, attitude you have, approach to living you have had, no longer works. And somehow or other, you've experienced the alternative to it, maybe just for a brief time. So maybe you realize that, as I did once, that it didn't work to try to get everyone in the world to like me. And not that I consciously had that as my life mission, but the idea of, kind of unconsciously, I was trying to get everyone to like me. And it's amazing the social gymnastics I would do to try to make that happen. At some point, I realized this doesn't work. I'm exhausting myself. And then when I realized it doesn't work, I knew an alternative. I knew a variety of alternative ways of being, but I knew that there was a way of being at peace that was free of the agitation, the contraction, of always on the search, looking, how do I make myself safe in this situation? How do I arrange and make sure people see me a certain way? And I realized I don't have to do all that. I knew that there was a way of feeling at home in myself that was not dependent on what other people thought of me. So I knew an alternative. I knew that a certain way that I was acting no longer worked, and I knew an alternative. And that alternative was deeply meaningful for me, was something that I knew, and I wanted to make it my orientation, an approach. I couldn't do it automatically, but I had a devotion then to, this is the path. I want to learn how to do this, to really shed this drive to always be liked. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being liked, right? So I'm not saying I became antisocial. But to have that as the, one of the primary drives was, was just a headache. I also, was thinking about, connected to that was also I saw how much I was trying to prop up a certain notion of self. I was attached and caught up in a certain idea of who I had to be. I had to be in relationship to ideals I carried. I had to be a certain way in relationship to what I thought my parents wanted, what my people around me wanted. And I knew there was an alternative. Initially, I knew the alternative more as an intuition. I knew I didn't have to hold on so tight to the sense of me, myself, and mine. And I knew it was possible to let go of it. And I was inspired, but I was afraid. And I could feel that fear. Sometimes I felt like I was the edge of the precipice, and I couldn't let go because it was too frightening to let go. But I knew that it was possible. I knew that's what I wanted to do. So there was a knowing, and it took a while for me to come to a point where I could finally let go of that and feel that it was actually safer to let go of the so-called security of having these self ideas. It's actually safer not to go around defining yourself all the time and needing to build it up and defend it and all that. So something that I knew. I was very much, I'm a kind of a forward-looking person more than a backward-looking person. So what that, one way that took for me was a lot of planning, a lot of thinking into the future, projection. And I had a lot of fear around the future, a lot of anxiety. And so that's the way I operated. And at some point, I knew that I was became disenchanted with that. At some point, I said, enough of this. I was no longer in the spell of somehow what I thought my planning about the future was going to do for me. I thought it was going to make me safe, make me wonderful. Sometimes I thought it would make me, I don't know, famous, I don't know what I was thinking, wealthy, all kinds of things that was driving me. And I saw the cost of being that way, planning and thinking and doing all that time. And I saw the exhaustion of it in my mind sometimes. And I also saw that I had a very poor prediction rate. And about what actually happened in the future. And that was actually one of the ways I started to get disenchanted with my planning mind, was to see that usually things didn't work out the way I thought they were supposed to work out. And so, you know, I'd be worried about some kind of meeting or something I had to go to, and, you know, and I was all this concern for it, and then the meeting was canceled, or the person I was most worried about didn't come, or, I mean, I can let, you know, there's like, you know, 10,000 ways in which things didn't kind of line up just the way that I thought they were going to be in my fearful thought, my mind. And then I knew there was an alternative. By that time, I had done a lot of meditation, and I had experienced a lot of feeling of being really settled at home in the present moment, and really had a visceral, immediate sense of what it's like to be settled in this body, to be settled in the mind and heart, and feel at home here, feel contented here, feel like this is great. This is a good place to be. And I could feel the difference between being settled in this real, live, connected moment now versus a kind of disembodied world of my ideas of the future, what might be, what could be, what all that. And I could actually start to feel the difference. You know, I can feel myself connected here. And it was fascinating to watch me lose it as I went into my planning mind. You know, and I went up to my head, or probably in my case, above my head. Because the head's already, you know, I was pretty disembodied at times. So the head's still in the body. So I don't know where I was, disappearing into my thoughts. And so these are some examples, and probably the idea is that you're supposed to come up with your own examples, because it's supposed to be personal, this path. It's not supposed to be someone else's path you walk when you do the Buddhist path. So how does this work for you? What are some of the ways of being that you've been, that you no longer believe in, you no longer are enchanted by, you no longer feel like that doesn't work anymore? You feel ready to relinquish them. And probably there are things that you've done over your lifetime, ways you've been, that probably you've outgrown, and you no longer are into them, And now you know an alternative. You know something better. But in terms of your Dharma practice and what Buddhism has to offer, this practice has to offer, for some people, it really touches in to the innermost, deepest aspects of who we are. The basic way in which we live our lives, the basic way that our hearts work. Suffering is, you know, something that is an equal opportunity employer. It'll spread out into all aspects of your life if you give it a chance. And so part of the great value of Dharma practice is that it's also equal opportunity. It stretches out and reaches out to all dimensions and domains of our life so that everything can be transformed and changed in a way that suffering is not there. There can be a deep abiding sense of happiness, of peace, of love, of compassion, of something that can be here. So the first part of the refuge is just knowing something. And the second is an orientation, is having that knowing and not being passive about refuge, it's not magical thinking. If I go for refuge, somehow the Buddha will take care of me. But to set a course for your life. This is important. I want to follow. This is the direction I want to go. This is the purpose or the orientation I have. I'm no longer going to be oriented towards fame or oriented towards status or oriented towards accumulating things or greed. I'm disenchanted with hate and hostility and revenge and resentment. It doesn't work to be always resentment. I don't know why I'm thinking about it, but a woman came to me many years ago and said that she had been divorced for many years, and she was still so bitterly resentful of her husband, ex-husband, and she was consumed by it. And then one day, she kind of was doing it again, and it occurred to her that he was out far gone and away from her, and so he probably never even thinks about me anymore. And he doesn't have any, thoughts about me. He's free of me in some ways. But I'm just consumed by all this suffering. I'm just doing all this terrible stuff to myself by living with this resentment. And when she realized the cost of what she was doing to herself, she got disenchanted with her resentment. And then she was able to put it down pretty quickly. When she realized it had no purpose, it wasn't like helping anyone, and it wasn't harming anyone. If it harmed her husband, maybe she would have kept it. it had a purpose then. But, it wasn't even harming him. The only person was harming herself, so then only then could she put it down. So, to have this orientation, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. And now it's not easy to put things down at all, but the orientation is, this is a direction I want to go in my life. And it comes along with a lot of beautiful qualities. Orientation towards being more ethical. Realizing it didn't work so well to be unethical. And it just feels really good to be ethical. Most people, I think, who practice meditation or Dharma for some time have an increased appreciation for the value of being ethical. Not because it's moralistic and, like this duty that you should be moral. But rather, you have this evidence inside, this personal, direct, visceral feeling that it just doesn't work. It doesn't feel good to be unethical. Why would you kind of take a kind of? Why would you take? A clean dish and make it all dirty before you put it away in the cupboard. You made it all clean and everything, and you're gonna put it away in the cupboard. Make it dirty first, right? You wouldn't do that. You keep it clean. So once you have this clean heart, why would you do anything? It just feels so good to keep it that way. So part of this orientation is to be ethical in speech and action and all kinds of ways. And to have an orientation, to have a direction or have a sense of purpose of practice, does not mean that you have to be good at it. It means you offer the best you can. You do the best you can and hopefully are inspired by that. It's such an amazingly good thing to have found a path towards freedom, towards this kind of freeing the heart, freeing the mind from all the contraction that is there, and all the ways in which we use our hearts, minds, and bodies to cause harm, harm to ourselves, harm to others. It's such a good thing to learn not to do it. To just be on the path in that direction is something to be celebrated and enjoyed. And then the last part, a refuge of love, of devotion, that it's an element of the heart. So I don't know what heart word works for you, wholehearted, that it's something that you're inspired by, something that there's a sense of dedication towards, or I like the word love, and that it's something that our love for ourselves, our love for the world, for others, is the fuel. The love for freedom is the fuel and support for what we do. So in that, with all that, then the refuge in the Dharma is the refuge in this path of practice. It's the refuge in the new way of living that follows path of mindfulness, the path of ethics, the path of wisdom, of investigation, looking more clearly and carefully, a path of compassion and love. There's a variety of practices and states of mind that are held under this title of the Dharma. And take refuge in the Dharma is take refuge in these practices and these qualities, these good qualities that we have within us. To some degree, also take refuge in the teachings that point to these practices, the value of them, and the possibility of freedom. To be inspired by that, to know that these are to know yourself that these are true and these are useful enough that you're willing to give them, your best effort. And one of the most important Dharma teachings and practices is known as the Four Noble Truths, which is usually comes down to us as a direct willingness, a willingness to directly look suffering in the face. And here suffering can mean, it's a kind of umbrella term for unease, dis-ease, being uneasy, in all the variety of ways we can feel that. Anguish, Zen teacher I studied with for a while liked to translate dukkha as anguish. Some people like to translate it as unsatisfactoriness, things are unsatisfactory, or we carry with us a feeling of that things are unsatisfactory and because they don't match our desires for what we want them to be. And if they're unsatisfactory, then the idea is not to be attached to them or put all our eggs in the basket of things which are unsatisfactory. So whatever the term is, I like suffering as a translation. To me, it kind of speaks to it all. Another translator prefers the word stress for dukkha because he says that stress is a more comprehensive term for dukkha than suffering. And once he told me that there's some list of some of the most stressful things that people have in their lives. And one of the very stressful things he said is getting married. And but usually people are happy, right? And you don't want to say it's suffering getting married. That doesn't seem quite right, but can be kind of stressful to do it. So he covers wider terms. But also he said it's because in deep states of meditation, there's no real suffering, but there can be a certain kind of stress that's there. And there can even be a lot of happiness and joy, but you can feel a subtle kind of stress. And that stress, by turning and facing it, opens the door to freedom from it. And so to be able to tune in to stress, have a sense of that this is a path there that opens up. So the Four Noble Truths begin with an honest willingness to look at suffering, the first noble truth. And to do that is not easy. And so often when people come to the Dharma, the beginning of it all is learning the skills, learning the ability to not cower from suffering, not fall back into the automatic reactions we have around it, blame and criticism and fear and resistance, and, you know, just all these things. But I'm not willing to feel, I'm not willing to be uncomfortable, and I don't want this, and it's too hard, and whatever. But it's quite an amazing thing to come to the place where you can suffer. And I don't want to say eagerly, but you can suffer willingly. Not that you want to suffer just to suffer better than everybody else, but you're willing to kind of look. Oh, here is something that's worth looking at, and not add, make it more complicated. It is not add suffering on top of suffering. Let me just look it right in the eye, just be with it. And if you've ever suffered yourself and had someone else who could just accompany you in your distress. And they felt they weren't trying to fix you. They just kind of were your companion. They were there. They could hear you. They can talk with you. They can kind of empathize with you. They were just there and feel nourished or supported by that person in very meaningful ways. That's what I'm talking about for yourself, to learn the ability to be your own companion for it and really see it and look it and be with it. And some of that comes from also learning to be sensitive, to notice suffering when it arises. And in fact, the sooner you can notice it, even the subtle ones, forms of suffering, the sooner you can address it so it doesn't build, to become worse and worse. I'm a great believer in the value of noticing suffering as early as possible, before it builds. The second noble truth is often taught as being the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering is said to be a certain kind of compulsivity, a drive, a thirst, a craving that goes on. And the good news about this is that it's a call to begin looking not at only suffering, but what is our contribution to that suffering? What are we doing? What psychologically, in our own minds, are we doing that somehow fuels the suffering or builds it or even makes it occur in the first place? Even when, in some ways, in conventional terms, you can say that he, she caused me a lot of suffering. You know, sometimes that's okay to say conventionally. You know, he, she sometimes do terrible things. But the Dharma, the way of Dharma practice, if you want to do the Dharma practice, if you want to do the conventional thing, which is appropriate sometimes, you say, you know, look what you did. But if you really want to find the Dharma path for yourself, you want to turn the attention 180 degrees around to see yourself. What is your contribution to this? You don't have to admit it to the other person if they're like, you know, being a bully, you know, because that maybe would not be helpful in the situation. But you know for yourself that you've contributed also to your own distress because maybe you've gotten angry and you're really holding on to that anger. Or you're really attached to having your way or your opinion or something. And so maybe it's a good opinion, but you're really holding on tight. And you can, and as you get more sensitive with mindfulness practice, you feel the cost of what it's like to hold on. And so the second noble truth is a call to not just look at suffering, but begin looking more deeply at, and I think compassionately, at what is your own contribution to this? What are you doing? What's happening inside of you? What are you holding on to? What is it that you're doing in your mind that you could let go of, that you can soften and loosen up on? Is a beautiful thing, beautiful step of taking responsibility for yourself, to really take responsibility. It's a kind of a grown-up thing to do. It's no longer waiting for others to change, no longer waiting for the circumstances to change. Then I'll be happy. No longer waiting for... I mean, there was one woman who sat at retreats with John and I for many years, and then many retreats, and then at some point she gave it all up. She was kind of a little angry at the Dharma and her practice, and she said, I've been sitting for so long that I thought if I just sat long enough I would be transformed. It's like Ajahn Sumedho, this teacher says, if sitting was where it's at, chickens would be enlightened. And she had a kind of magical thinking. She had kind of a magical thinking that if she just went through the motions of sitting and going on retreats, that something would happen to her, like it would be done for her. But a very important part of this Dharma practice is take responsibility, not to look elsewhere. But so this idea of turning in, what am I doing? What are the second arrows that I shoot? What is happening for me? Now, one of the fascinating things to explore in this regard has to do with our thoughts. And it's really interesting to consider how much thoughts are at the source of how we suffer. So in my, not to say they're all suffering, but like in my example of my planning the future, I had all these imaginary futures. And I suffered because of them. I was afraid of them. I was anxious about not getting them. I was anxious about getting them. All kinds of things that had its birth in my thoughts. Some of you heard this story. I got my attention. It's like being hit over the head with a sledgehammer, because sometimes I'm a slow learner. And so I spent a year working in the monastery kitchen, Tassajara kitchen. And the summer, there's a guest season. It's kind of like a resort. And I was in charge of the kind of supervising the kitchen. But the primo job was being what's called the guest cooks. There were three of them. And they cooked the really good food for the guests. And I was just a supervisor, made sure all the work got done. But I wasn't one of the cooks, the chefs, right? But I was, by the end of the year, I was the best cook. You know, I was really good. I learned how to do it. I was fast and skillful. And I looked around the monastery and who else was available. I said, you know, obviously, next year, I'm going to be chosen to be the guest cook. So I was, you know, certain that was going to happen. And so from September to, I think, April or May, we had these 2 3-month practice periods. Like we're doing a retreat here, like I did, you know, we did a retreat for two 3-month retreats. We would do our meals in the meditation hall, kind of like sitting here like you are, like I am here. They had a platform, everyone sat on a platform all around the edges of the room. And we would sit facing out like this, and we have our eating bowls in front of us like this, with three of them, little bowls like this. And the servers would come into the meditation hall. We'd be sitting there like this in meditation. And they'd come and we'd bow to them. They'd put their pots down, lift up your bowl. They pour the rice in. Then you sit there for a while. Then another server comes with a soup and you hold your bowl up and they put the soup in and you sit there. And then you wait until everyone's served. And then you chant. And then they hit a clapper. Then you eat silently. And it's all choreographed. But, you know, there was a lot of time just sitting there, you know. So I spent, you know, every meal for 6 months not meditating like you're supposed to, like this, you know, during those meals, I was planning menus. And I would be analyzing the food and thinking about how I would do it and thinking about what I was going to cook when I became a guest cook. And, you know, I was convinced that this was going to happen. So then, when the time came to do the assignments for, you probably know the story now, right? The assignments for the summer, we all stood in the meditation hall and it kind of formed, well, everything's kind of ritual and Zen, right? So we stood all around the edges of the meditation hall and they started reading out in a dignified voice, you know, what our jobs were. And they came and said my name, and it was not in the kitchen. And I said, what? And so at first I said, what? And then the next thing I thought was, what was I doing all those months? What a waste of time. I could have been meditating. I could have been, you know, doing something productive and useful for my time. All this menu planning and planning how I was going to do the work and all this stuff was, what a waste. So, what do we do with our thoughts? I've had thoughts about what other people are going to think about me. Again, it's just, and because of that, I've suffered. I've had thoughts about myself. I've judged myself. I'm somehow all messed up. I'm somehow guilty. Guilt is short for guilt, you know. Somehow everyone else understands, but I don't understand, and so I had all this kind of negative feelings about myself. But as I started practicing, I saw how much it was born in having thoughts, ideas about myself. Ideas about what it should be for other people. And there's a certain kind of overcommitment that many of us have to thinking and planning and visualizing, imagining things that are not happening. Things about the future, other places, what might happen. Some of this is useful. It's not wrong to plan. It's not wrong to think this way. But it can be overdone. We can be enchanted by it or caught in the spell of that. And what's interesting to do is to watch how suffering is connected to that, the movement of thoughts and ideas. And is it possible, is it necessary to tie our well-being to what we are thinking? Do we have to sacrifice the good quality of our heart, being settled, being at ease, because of the thoughts that we have? One of the things I've come to appreciate a lot in this practice is doesn't have to have anything to do with Buddhism at all, or even the practice, but it's a practice in Buddhism that brought me to it, and that is the miracle, the complete miracle of being alive now. The sense of clarity or sense of being conscious now. And it was for a long time in my life, I couldn't really feel the miracle, the specialness of that, the sense of home, the peace, the well-being, the vitality of that, because my vision was clouded by all these thoughts and ideas and desires. I'm quite capable of having desires. For me, desires are a dime a dozen. I'm pretty relaxed about my desires now. That's kind of like how my mind works. Some people are aversion minds, and so aversions are a dime a dozen. In Buddhism, they say it's better to have an aversive mind than a desire mind, if you get to choose. choose the aversive mind. However, you can cause much more damage with the aversive mind than a desire mind. But the advantage of an aversive mind in Buddhism is that you can more effectively and wisely say no. I'm not going to do that anymore. No more of that. And the desire types, anyway, I got to see the limitations of being caught up in desire. And having being driven by them and wanting them and expecting them. I still have desires, but mostly they're innocent and fine, and and I can just let them go by. I don't mind. I can choose the ones that are useful. But it wasn't always the case. So this the specialness of this moment. And there are people who have only really discovered that at the time they're going to die. Something about the contact with their own dying. Sometimes you see it with other people who are dying. Some of you might have had the experience of being at the bedside of someone, and past, the future, outside of that room doesn't really exist. Just that room is there. And sometimes there can be a very profound stillness and peacefulness in that room that is unprecedented kind of feeling of being settled. And so some people have that as they approach their own dying. And we've had people through our IMC community who've died. And we had one woman who was dying of ALS, which is not an easy thing to die from. And she was kind of, you know, and people in the IMC community started visiting her, you know, having vigils, sitting with her, meditating with her. And people wanted to go see her. Like, you couldn't keep people away because they felt like, wow, she's our teacher. There was a kind of a sense of peace and equanimity that was palpable and meaningful to be in the presence of. She was not distressed. She was not afraid. There's something about for her that so many things dropped away. And she demonstrated to others a profound possibility of how we can be alive, how we can live. Until near the very end, actually the last evening she was alive, because she had ALS, she had trouble swallowing and breathing at some point. So I think she wasn't getting enough oxygen in her brain. And she kind of said to me, at some point she said, "My practice is not working anymore. And I'm seeing all these things, visions and hearing these things, and she was kind of confused by it. And she started getting agitated. And I can't practice anymore. She didn't have her mindfulness practice, And I said to her, about these visions and things you heard, I said, "It's okay. Just don't believe them." And then she relaxed. And then a couple hours later, she died. So to the second noble truth, to be able to turn and start looking, what's underneath this suffering of ours? What are the beliefs that we carry with us? And the beliefs sometimes are subconscious. They're kind of just assumed. Sometimes we have deep beliefs that we just think it's just inherent in the nature of the universe that we're this way. I saw that with my kids, when my son, I don't know how old he was, fairly young, I have such a strong acculturation into individualistic mindset. I grew up in a very individualistic culture, strong individualism. And it's just one of the ways cultures can organize themselves. It's not necessarily bad, but it has its weaknesses. And I saw at some point that the very, very kind of seemingly innocent, ordinary ways, the ways that I related to my 2-3-year-old son and talked to him was acculturating him in the same individualism. But by this time, I'd done all these years of practice that I knew that these were mental constructs, they were ideas, they weren't inherent in the nature of reality. And I could see that, and so I could start taking more responsibility for it. But before I practiced, I wouldn't have seen it at all. I just thought, of course, we want to develop strong individuals. That's just how it is. I hadn't been to Asia and saw a collectivist culture where there's a very different orientation of how to be a person and be in society. So we have these deep beliefs of what we need. I need to have this. This needs to happen. This is what has, deep, deep beliefs about what shouldn't happen, what should happen. And these beliefs sometimes are the genesis of our suffering. We have deep, deep drives. The drive for existence, the drive for sexuality, the drive for sense of belonging, a drive for being right, a drive for all kinds of things. Just because it's a strong, deep drive inside of us, doesn't mean that we have to go along. You don't have to be the passenger in the car that's driving that way. It's possible, actually, to put to rest some of these drives or not buy into them. See them for what they are. Say, "Oh, it's just a drive. I don't have to kind of, you know, be pushing for it. Some of you might have been the recipient, the undesired. You did not want to receive. Be in the receiving end of someone's very strong sexual interest, but it just might drive. You know, take it somewhere else. You know. So we have this drive. We don't have to live by these drives. They're not necessarily wrong, but they can cause a lot of suffering. The third noble truth is the possibility of bringing the suffering to an end by learning how to let go, relinquish, step aside, put down, not participate in some of these thoughts, some of these beliefs, some of these drives that we have. It's not an easy thing to do, especially when you're talking about really going deep down into the heart. But boy, is it a wonderful path to be on to do this, to really kind of look at oneself deeply and to be with and to kind of move in that direction. And then because it's not so easy, there's the Eightfold Path, a path of eight sets of practices that supports us to do this work. And that's maybe for another time to talk about the Eightfold Path, but you know, you're not expected to kind of overnight suddenly let go of your suffering, but you can, if you wish, put together the conditions that allows you to do the inner work, to have the strength of mindfulness, the strength of calm, so you can really see what's going on there, so that you can begin living in a different way. No longer living in the old way, but living in the new way. There were two experiences I had when I was quite young. Well, quite young meant when I was, I guess I was, the first one I think I was 18, and the second one I was about 20. 18, I was traveling around Europe by myself, and I ended up going to Mont Saint-Michel. It's a Catholic monastery on a kind of an island off the coast of like Brittany and Normandy. And from a distance, it looks like it's made by Disneyland. It's kind of this big spiring monastery with a big sharp spire in the middle. It's on top of a nice beautiful hill and on the island. And so I got a tour of the monastery. And the monastery has genesis with a little chapel, stone chapel that was built about 1,200 years ago. And then the monastery slowly was built around the little chapel. And there's some big, big meeting halls, but the top of the hill is still this little chapel. It's everything's big, gaudy monasteries around. And so we got this tour, and we walked into this chapel. And when we walked into this chapel, I experienced a kind of peace that I never had before. Everything got still. And that sense of peace and stillness showed me, oh, this is possible. This is possible. Then when I was 20, I was living on a farm in Norway, and the farmers went on vacation for a week and left me taking care of the cows. So for a week, I didn't see anyone but my girlfriends. We were very intimate. And so twice a day, I would I would milk them and feed them and take them out to pasture and all these things. And but I'd never been alone in my life. You know, I was just 20 years old and I didn't see anybody else for a week. And I didn't really know much about meditation that time. And so I just kind of lived my life. And I noticed that as the days went along, my mind got less agitated, got quieter. There were less, I didn't stop thinking, but there was also a greater clarity. I was amazed by how clear my vision was. Like I could see. It wasn't like things were sharper. Always need my glasses, but it was like things were shown. There was a shining quality to everything I looked at. And even my thoughts kind of felt like they were shining. They're kind of special. It didn't matter what I was thinking. So just, and I felt so intimate. I could see my thoughts in such clarity that I never saw before. Kind of clarity. Wow. Just a thought. Just there. And I felt so intimate, so good, felt so whole. And then the farmers came back and it went away. And when that happened, I decided my lot is not to be a hermit. That didn't make sense to me. I decided, so my task is to learn how to be alone with others. That didn't mean aloof or indifferent, you know, but it meant how to have the sense of deep well-being, intimacy, connected to myself, sense of aliveness, vitality, clarity. That's what being alone meant. In social environments with other people, because I saw how quickly I lost it. My concern for others, what they thought of me, what they should be doing, what should happen to them. Now that I have kids, I can see there's a whole new level of ways in which I get caught because, oh, I have to take care of my kids and, you know, and all this stuff, and I get caught. I mean, it's a little bit harder when you have kids, but it can be done. And so those two experiences were formative for me, and it kind of, didn't exactly say, I don't want to do something else, but I know, oh, this is a direction to go. This is a path. And so when I really started practicing Buddhism, those were there in the background, kind of saying, oh, there's a direction here, there's a possibility here. And I was inspired by it. I loved it. It was like it's like you love something that's more intimate than intimate, like so cherished or so deep or so precious or so wonderful. I don't know. And so to take refuge in the Dharma is not to go to the Dharma as kind of magical thinking. It's not to go to, but to go with knowing something, to go with a new orientation of how you want to live your life, and to do it with something like love, something with compassion, with care, with caring for yourself, caring for others, it's a beautiful thing, the refuge in the Dharma. And we don't just do it for ourselves, we do it for others as well. In fact, I think that if you only did it for yourself, this whole path, you wouldn't do it very far. You wouldn't go very far. But to really take the full potential of what this practice can do to transform you and the world, we do it for both self and others. Support others in this practice as well, or show other people a possibility. Maybe you can be the way you are. Maybe you can be the equivalent of that 1,200-year-old chapel that I walked into. Maybe someone can run into you, just like people came to see Hilda, who died of ALS. She was the equivalent for people of the 1,200-year-old chapel. They go into her presence and feel everything got still and quiet. So, last thing I'll say is tying these two together. The second characteristic is the characteristic of dukkha, of suffering. It can be seen as the bad news of Buddhism. But it's not Buddhism, it's about the world. There's so much dukkha. But we're connected to refuge in the Dharma, to refuge. This is what makes it come, you know, it kind of puts it in a context that is hopefully inspiring, meaningful, and perhaps, if we're lucky, brings a certain level of joy at your good fortune to bring these two together, the Dharma and your suffering. So let's take a minute to recollect ourselves and back into the meditation mode.